Welcome back to CTO Playbook, the podcast dedicated to helping CTOs excel. I've recently been focusing more on recruiting than I've done in ages, both helping my coaching clients and actively involved for some other clients. In this episode, I'll cover the end-to-end process of recruiting from the decision to make a hire all the way through the decision-making process to passing the probation period. There should be something for everyone in here with a framework that you can use entirely or just pluck ideas out and add it to your existing processes. Recruiting is a foundational skill for all CTOs, and getting it wrong can be costly, frustrating, and time-consuming. Getting it right builds awesome teams and can help create incredible outcomes. Hi, I'm Adam Horner, and I coach early career CTOs navigating their first leadership roles. I empower tech leaders to break free from the daily grind of crisis management and build the skills to lead with confidence, purpose, and clarity. Many CTOs I work with are former engineers who were promoted into leadership and overwhelmed with constant firefighting, unsure how to communicate effectively with non-technical executives, and uncertain about their strategic impact. Drawing on over 30 years of hands-on experience, I provide practical, personalized coaching tailored to these exact challenges, helping CTOs shift from reactive problem-solving to proactive strategic leadership. My coaching helps each CTO forge their own path for growth, allowing them to delegate confidently, align engineering with business goals, and step into their roles as trusted, respected peers at the executive table. This podcast is my way of giving back to the communities of CTOs that have supported me over the years. And between me and my guests, we cover crucial topics for CTOs, providing insights, strategies, and practical advice to help you build and refine your own playbook to excel as a CTO. Since the recruiting market is beginning to move again, and is likely to keep accelerating next year in 2025, I'm going to relatively quickly cover the many stages of the recruiting process and cover the key points that I've picked up and finish off with my CTO recruitment playbook of the five most important aspects of the whole process. So what does the overall process look like from my perspective then? Well, it starts off with the decision to hire, setting out the target organizational structure you're recruiting into. We're going to cover quickly reputation and employer branding, the role description, the job advert, how do you find people, or otherwise known as talent sourcing. We'll go through the interview stages and gates. We'll cover the candidate funnel and any metrics you should be collecting, scoring and benchmarking. How do we compare candidates as they come through the process? Making the offer, onboarding, and finally, how do we use probation periods, if at all? So let's start at the beginning then. So we've got a target organizational structure. We've got some gaps in it. We know that we need to recruit something, and so we make a decision to hire somebody. The most important thing, I think, is to put this new role in a roadmap of our organizational chart so we understand where it is and what kind of role it is. Is it a replacement role, or is it a strategic hire for new changes? What will be the team structure that will go around this person? And if they're a leader, what kind of budget will they have for recruiting others further on into the process? Making sure you've got internal alignment around that is really important to making sure that the outcome of the recruitment process is consistent with what you actually hope to get out of it from the first decision. So what are we going to use to attract people to our organization? I think a lot of the reputation and employer branding aspects, they start with months in advance, often positioning your organization or company as an exciting tech employer, an exciting place to work. And depending on what your culture is, do you create innovation? Do you generate great business outcomes? Do you have a great camaraderie amongst the team? Whatever it is, understanding what that is and being able to promote that externally is well worth spending some time putting some blogs out there, maybe even guesting on a podcast or two, making sure you get the word out about what it is that your organization stands for and what your engineering organization within that does and why it's a great place to work. If you get this right, it can quite literally reduce the cost of hiring. It can allow you to attract people with the right attitude and therefore ultimately pay a lower salary than you would have to just to attract somebody to a generic, undifferentiated organization. So once we've got our employer branding in place, the next thing to think about then is the actual role description itself. And I'm going to split here between the role description and the job advert, because I think they're two different things and you use them in two different contexts. So the role description then should be an exact purpose of what the role is. And in some cases, a definition of success. What does a good recruit in this role look like? What will winning look like for the person who gets the role in the end? One of the things you should also think about there in terms of what are the typical tasks or typical skills that are going to be needed to fulfill this role? What level is it at? Is it junior? Is it a mid-level? Is it senior? Is it somebody who has typically a load of years of experience? Or is it somebody who's got a certain threshold in terms of what they've done before? Being able to cast that correctly as part of the role description helps position it to somebody reading it to understand if they're the right person for the role or not. That background experience can be really important to help somebody realize, I'm the kind of person who fits that role, or this role needs experiences and backgrounds that I don't have. The other thing to think about as well is in some cases, some roles have prerequisites or qualifications. For example, do you need some sort of security accreditation? Do you need some sort of qualifications in place? Do you need to have a particular nationality or particular other qualifying attribute of who you are as part of the role description? Once you've got your role description then and agreed it internally, then we need to create our job advert. Now, the job advert at its core will, of course, be the role description. But we also need to sell the role, sell the benefits of working in this organization, sell the learnings that we're going to get or that the candidate's going to get it when they win the role, when they get into the company. But it's also important to sell the company itself and, if different, sell the product. So what is it that the winning person is going to be working on? Is it a service? Is it a product? Is it something that's part of the company, that's the sole thing that the company delivers? Or is it one product amongst many within the company? Positioning that and making it clear as part of the job advert, again, will allow people to realize this is the kind of organization I want to work for. This is the kind of benefits, value, service of a company that I want to be part of. So now we created our job advert and we've put it out there. We need to think about how we're going to source candidates. How are we going to find people? There's quite a lot of options. LinkedIn is a fairly popular one. Referrals is very powerful, but the two can be quite different. So getting your existing employees to refer other people that they know, other people that they've worked with, or to tap into their network can be a really powerful way of recruiting great people who are probably going to fit well and probably have a good understanding of what the organization is when they join. On the other hand, if you go out to something really generic like LinkedIn, you're basically just putting up an advert that literally anybody can apply to. And sometimes it can depend on A, how much you spend on ads, or B, how strong your network is in the first place. Of course, one of the ways we often get over this hurdle is to use recruiters. Recruiters are an important and interesting way of recruiting new candidates. And especially for larger organizations, you'll find that there's often very good relationships already in place. Those existing relationships are great because they should, in theory, already understand the culture of your organization, understand some of the processes that are in place for recruiting for you, and they should save you a lot of time from doing a lot of that yourself. So one of the things I see in startups is that they tend to try not to use recruiters. It can save some money because recruiters take a fee. My experience is that many recruiters earn that fee. They work for it and they help you and they do a lot of the work and make the process smoother and easier for you. For certain roles, you're going to want to consider targeting very specific people. And this tends to be for the leadership roles. Headhunters, not quite the same as recruiters. What they do is they will tend to form a very specific profile of who they're looking for, and they will go out and find people specifically who are going to match that. Very good for very specific, very niche roles. Maybe there's certain very unique skills, science or other backgrounds that can be quite niche, useful headhunters there. They've got a good knowledge of that area. Or of course, the senior leadership as well. So we've gone through from the decision to hire all the way through to getting to the point where we're looking at where we can get talent from, pull them in the door. So now we need to go through the bit that we tend to think of as the hard part of recruiting, or the bulk of the work in recruiting, which is the interviewing and filtering people. And I sort of break this down into several stages. The very first one is the CV review, the CV screening stage. Then we get into technical interviews, coding assessments, cultural fit or cultural ad assessments. In some organizations, in some roles, you want to do some sort of architectural or standards-based check to make sure that the person qualifies for the role as needed. And then also, it's sometimes with some roles useful to do some sort of situational achievement assessment as well. So let's go through those. So when it comes to CV screening, the hardest part to be with CV screening is consistent. And in general, If you think about the sales funnel, you want to be going for a lot of people at the beginning and narrowing that down through the process. CV screening really should just be ruling out the most unlikely candidates. It should be at this stage probably a default yes, unless you're very clear, I've already been very clear from previous recruitments of the similar or same role as to exactly what you need. One of the things I like considering as well is a group interview process. Now, this could be something that comes early on. It could become later on. It could be on the back of a technical or coding test. It could be the coding test itself. But group interviewing is a difficult one to get right, because you often end up with different people in the interview for different candidates through a process. So creating consistency can be really hard, but that can be helped. So who is going to lead the interview process? Who is going to observe? Who's going to ask which questions? Who's going to look for which aspects? Agree all of these things up front and you can create a level of consistency. We'll come on to the decision-making process afterwards, but that's also an important part of group interviewing as well. It's really important to try and get everybody to have a unique perspective on the candidate without being influenced by the others. Coding assessments, I quickly touched on that. It can be useful to use an external test service. It at least means that it's a benchmark. A lot of organizations I work with use a sort of a homemade scenario, often taking some part of the existing code, existing structure, or a previous state of the code and using that as a scenario to get a candidate to either write something or critique something, go through. The most important thing is that the scenarios in coding assessment actually reflect the work. If you're not going to be building binary trees in the work, then why get somebody to prove that they can do a binary tree sort in the coding interview test? I think the other thing to think about as well is some sort of respect for the candidates. Asking them to do a lot of hours of work can be counterproductive and may actually rule people out of applying for the role that you've got because you're asking too much of them. So bear that in mind. It is good to understand how well people can code for a coding role, but be proportional about the amount of code or time and effort you ask people to put into it. When it comes to assessing some of the architectural and standards assessments, again, consistency is really hard. So one of the things I think it's quite useful to do is to build up a pool of questions that your organization uses and that you share amongst all the people who are recruiting for this role so that you get a consistent set of questions. And therefore a benchmark of scorable answers against those because you've used consistent questions. Again, not every candidate's going to be the same. Not every candidate's going to be easily comparable, but the best you can do is going to be to have a consistent set of questions to use there. The ideal is you have a consistent interviewer for each role. It's not always possible. Sometimes you can, sometimes you just have to have different people in the recruitment process. Holidays and time off and everything else. One of the hardest things to assess, I find, is the cultural fit or cultural add element. How well is this person going to fit into our team? What are they going to bring to it that we don't already have? And I often, especially for engineering roles, I get somebody outside of engineering to help with this part of it. There's a couple of ways of doing that. One of them is just to simply say, you know, can you just give 15 minutes talking to this person and cover some of these elements? Often organizations have a list of values or a culture statement, something of which, again, you can check people. One of the ways I like to do that as well is to put that as a sandwich. So you'll have a tough interview, maybe it's an individual interview, a group interview, and then right in the middle, put an interview process in there, which looks like it's just, oh, somebody's going to sit down and answer some questions with you or have a coffee with you in between the two, show you around the building. But that person is also going to be assessing them. How do they behave during that time when the pressure comes off before they go into the next one? You want to make sure that people behave consistently from when they're in the interviews to when they're in between the interviews and that they treat everybody equally, whether they think that they're in line for making the decision or whether they're not. So that's one thing that you can add into your process there is to what I call it the pressure release test. See how they behave in that. Questions. Deciding on questions and which questions to use in individual questions, in group questions, notoriously tough. The ideal goal is you have something that's easy to pass so that every candidate has a great feeling coming out of their interview, feeling, I was able to answer that. But also that you have a great threshold in there so that somebody who can excel is able to teach you something. It's one of the really good flags, I think, is if somebody comes into an interview and teaches you something as the interviewer, that's normally a really good sign. So if you can build your questions in such a way that somebody who's got a relatively low level of knowledge or experience can get a passing grade or an answer that's credible without too much effort, but then there's plenty of room for you to be able to ratchet it up and raise the complexity of the scenario, look at something more complex. I think it's really helpful to create a good experience as well as get a good assessment of the candidate as they come through. Now, for non-technical roles, maybe you're recruiting for support roles, maybe you're recruiting for some of the product or design roles, situational achievement assessments, I think, are very useful as well. I normally use these as an alternative to technical assessments. I don't normally combine them. Occasionally, I do for leadership. And that would be using something like the STAR method, which is the situation, task, action, result. It's essentially saying, tell us a time when you're in this kind of scenario, what you did, and what the outcome was. And that's quite useful for scenario-based work. If somebody's doing, for example, support work or leadership work, you can use those to get, again, a consistent set of answers from people in terms of how they approach certain scenarios, how they would help people out. And you can often get a good view of how people think about certain scenarios. Cool. So that's interviewing. I've not gone into too much detail there. Most organizations know how to do that technical assessment, but just in terms of different stages and how to put it together, several different options for you there. In terms of the typical approach that I would take, I would do a CV screen, a one-on-one broad experience interview, just to check that the person essentially is the same person that says on the CV. This would be 15, 20 minutes, a relatively short interview. Again, that stage there is to quickly knock people out who clearly don't meet the requirements. I'd then have some sort of coding test or coding take-home approach, then a group interview where you'd have several people interviewing technically against the requirements for the role. And then finally, some sort of senior interview role as the last one. And that last one is going to be a combination of some checks. Maybe there's some steps from before that you wanted to double check people, but also a sales approach. So in that last interview, you're very much trying to sell the role, sell the company, sell the organization, because by that stage, you should be fairly confident that they're going to go through. So with those stages then, let's talk about the funnel. And the funnel is hopefully wide at the front, lots of people applying, and that you rule people out as each stage progresses until you get down to the one, two, or three that you're going to consider actually making an offer to. So one of the things that when you're recruiting repeatedly, or recruiting at scale, then making sure that you're tracking your candidate funnel metrics can be really important to help you feed back into the process as to how well you're doing, what can be optimized, where are you losing too many candidates, where have you got inconsistencies in this people going through from one stage to the next, and try and improve the process at scale. If you're just recruiting for one role, running metrics on it, probably not going to be that much to learn from it on the whole. So I spoke about technical interviews and group interviews. Let's talk about how we score and benchmark people. It's very tempting to just create a yes, no answer to most hiring decisions, but I find it's useful to try and create a range of outcomes. And the model that I like most was one that I actually learned back at Palantir. And it basically goes on four different levels, four outcomes you can have. The two obvious ones in the middle are hire or don't hire. And fairly obviously, hire is, I like this person. I think I'd like to work alongside them. I'd like them to join the team. So I would hire them. Don't hire should be the default answer. If you're not sure, if you're on the fence, then it should be a no hire. I'll always refer to, for example, the great coach Yoda, actually, when it comes to hiring, because he often said,
oh, do not.
So if you're in between, do not. That should be a default answer in most cases. If you're really, really impressed with this candidate and you think, look, I'm actually going to question my position at the company if you don't hire this person, then that's a strong hire. And when it comes to negotiations, talking, you should be able to create some standout examples why you think this person is a strong hire. And on the other end of the scale, there's a strong no hire. Again, if you see some red flags, if you see something you think, as I don't want to be working alongside this person at all, then you'd have a strong no hire. In all the times I've been recruiting, I've probably seen three or four times that people have seen those two extreme answers. Most of the time, it's going to be a group of people, two, three people, negotiating around hire, no hire, and their experience of working with them. When it comes to making sure that you don't influence other people, I also like to do a blind vote, especially for group interviews. So if you have an interview panel of, say, three people, you would then, at the end of the interview process, after the candidate has gone away, each of you would write down on a piece of paper what your score is from strong hire to strong no hire, and then reveal all this all at the same time. The idea there is to try not to influence each other so that you come up with an independent score, and then you can debate after that as to where the candidate actually sits on the overall scoring system and whether you're going to progress them through to the next round or not. So through all of this stage, we've got the candidate experience as well. So I'm just going to make a bit of a tangent off into the candidate experience. I've touched on it slightly earlier on. There's a bunch of things that we as candidates, when we're applying for roles, we know we like or we know that we don't like. We don't like being ghosted. We may like to get answers back. We don't like long times in the process. Now, long processes aren't necessarily bad, but our experience of long processes is where we go from one stage where, for example, we had an interview and then we don't hear for quite a while. That makes it feel long. Whereas if we finish the interview and then we get an answer that says, you'll find out about the next stage in this many days, it creates a sense of predictability, of certainty. And so therefore, fast responses, I think, create a really great candidate experience. Clear communications. How long is the process? What is the next stage? Where are you in the process? These all help with creating a great candidate experience. Good feedback on when you on the decline as to why the organization is declining you is also important. I think quite a lot of the times, a decline is often rather than we don't think you're up to the job, it's normally you don't fit exactly what we're looking for. And so being able to tell somebody why they don't fit will probably help them with their ongoing job search. And that can be really helpful. And it doesn't take too long to do. And it can create a really good experience. Somebody who's gone through a really great candidate experience is much more likely to recommend the role or the company to other job seekers as well. And it's always worth considering that each person is like a mini network in their own right. If you give them a great experience, hopefully they will bring more people in, or at least they won't deter others from joining and coming on to the process and joining your organization. To do that, to make that process really good, I think it's really important to use either a CRM, a candidate relationship management, or the other tool type is the ATS, the applicant tracking system. They're much maligned platforms, but when you're recruiting at scale, they can really help the process and make sure that the ball doesn't get dropped between decisions, things that need to do, people who've been stuck in a certain stage for too long, etc. So I think that's those systems really help. If you're just recruiting one person, then you can be a bit more manual about it, but try not to drop the ball. Try to keep that candidate experience great. So hopefully now then you've got a bunch of candidates, you've taken them through a process, you've got metrics on that funnel, and you got to the point where you've got one or maybe even two people you think, yeah, they could do the job. It's time to make an offer. Now, most of the time, making an offer is fairly straightforward. You make a decision on what offer you're going to make them. You'll put the offer to them, and then you'll hope to get an answer back. And you'll hope it'll be a positive answer. I would say when you make an offer, always try and make the offer in person, as much in person as possible. So either face-to-face or on a video call, or at the very worst, on an audio call. Making an offer as a sent document doesn't often end up in a great experience. So if you can, the more personal you can make the offer, brilliant. The other thing I would say as well is really important is to add a deadline onto the offer. So make an offer, you need to decide by X. If you leave the deadline too long, what you'll find is that most candidates are in multiple processes. And so therefore, if they can push the decision so they can hear from somebody else, they can keep more maybes in the air for longer, and you're more likely to get a no. So put a deadline in that's reasonable. And you'll often have an idea from the process of what is a reasonable deadline for the candidate in question. So don't have a hard and fast rule that says you've got 5 days. Think about it from the point of view, if this candidate, they said that they're in two other processes, well, when would be a reasonable time for them to make a decision by? Check with them, make it mutual, but put a deadline in. Hopefully then they'll accept. Yay, we have a new employee. What next? And I think that the process from an employee when they're about to join until they do join, so often you'll end up with a notice period or some sort of delay before they actually start the company. And that period can be sort of no man's land. You hope that they're going to sign the contract, then hand in their notice to their existing employer, and then give you a date when they're going to start and confirm that. In that intervening period, there's a lot of things that you can do. And you can actually start your onboarding earlier than when they actually join. Some of it just, you know, including them in things that happen within the team now. If the team go out for drinks, invite them too, even though it's 2 weeks before they start. If you are going to have an event that's coming on, a company event, consider inviting them along to that. May not be possible, may not be allowed in all scenarios, but consider it. At very least, check in with them, something like weekly, reconfirming that they're going to come and join on the start date. And then when they start, onboarding. Onboarding documentation, onboarding processes is one of those things that is, I think, not done well enough in the vast majority of organizations. A really great onboarding, people remember it and talk about it for ages. And it's not just the swag that's on the desk when you arrive at the new company. It's the whole process of what it's like to meet the most important people first. What that first day experience is like. How much pressure is there? What's the first week experience? How quickly do you get to the point where you feel like you're delivering value and doing something good? And then what is the first sort of 30 days, 60 days, 90 days is what people typically talk about that works for larger organizations. For startups, that might be 45 days. But the point is there should be a sort of a relatively structured approach to the first day, week, month of when somebody joins. And one of the best things I've found for if you're an early stage startup and you have never done onboarding, or even if you're a large organization, you've got a really established process, handing the ownership of the onboarding process itself to the people who join as they go through it so they're fully empowered and expected to update that onboarding documentation themselves and make it better for the next person who onboards is really powerful. Who better to know what is missing from that, what they don't know, than the person who's going through it? Hand over the onboarding documentation to the new starter and leave them with the task of leaving it better than they found it. The last thing to think about then is that transition from being the new person to being an established member of the team. Now, in the EU, we quite often have, and in the UK as well, we quite often have probation periods. And that could be 30 days, it could be sometimes longer. In the US and the rest of the world, it's not really standard and not really done. So it may be completely irrelevant for some people in different jurisdictions, in different cultures. But in the EU and the UK, if you have a probation period, you should use it. And the reason for a probation period is because letting people go or firing people is a lot harder than it is in an at-will hiring situation like it is in the US. And so therefore, the probation period gives you that early stage time when it's much easier to let somebody go without a large process or involvement of an employment union or something like that. So use that probation period. Define what success looks like for the probation period. And when somebody passes that threshold, celebrate it because it's an important point. And it means that they've got the same risk profile as everybody else in the team. So recruitment then. A long process, when you think about it all the way from the decision all the way to the end of somebody's probation period. And if you're recruiting a lot of people, you've probably got a lot of those things overlapping. So being organized and coordinated about it is really important. The larger the organization, the more people you'll have involved in this process, everything from the decision-making through to the legal aspects and the onboarding process. So the more joined up the process is, the better the experience is for the candidates, the better you will find your team building over time. So hopefully, therefore, I've given you a bit of a shallow overview maybe, but the whole process of recruiting and without going down into too much detail. So my five key steps then that for me make the whole process stand out. Invest in the whole process end to end for the best results. It's a long process and it has the biggest impact on your organization overall. Best to invest in it. If you're going to pick and choose where you invest, I would say investing in those early stages of the process has the most impact. You can get away with delegating a lot or leaving a lot of things at the last minute. You can, if you're recruiting a lot of people, you can, as I say, hand over that onboarding process to people who are joining. They can make the process better. The more you invest up front, getting the right decision, the right structure, and the right role description before people come in, that's where the most impact is. Number three, teach your team how to recruit. Very few organizations teach recruiting or actively work on developing it to make it better. The better you can make everybody's experience of the recruiting process, the better the process is, the more smoothly it runs. So if you can teach your team how to recruit, if you can have retros on the recruiting process, on the interviewing process, and have reviews of the actual tests and tasks you're getting candidates to go through, the more powerful you can make your whole organization at getting in great people. Four, I'd say default to not hiring. Any red flag should knock a candidate out of the process, right? Remember the Yoda thing, do or do not. There is no try. So make sure you're very certain about the people you're bringing on board and default to no in almost all scenarios. The cost of a bad hire is extremely high. And if we can avoid that in the process, we should. And then lastly, try and create the most amazing onboarding experience you can. Think about it from the point of view of, what do you wish you had had when you joined? Try and create that for the people who are joining in. So invest in the whole process. Invest time in the early stages for the most impact. Teach your team how to recruit. Default to not hiring and create an amazing onboarding experience. So there you go. I'd love to hear what you think about the recruiting process. I'm sure there's a lot of different approaches and a lot of different opinions. I'd love to hear about it as well. Join the community, the CTO Playbook community, and get involved. And tell us what you think about it. Keep leading with impact. See you on the next episode. Thanks very much. Thank you very much for listening all the way through to the end. Just before you go, I'd like to ask you for one thing in return for putting together all these episodes of the CTO Playbook podcast for you. Please leave a review. Wherever you're listening, whether that is Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whichever platform you're on, leaving a quick review will help more CTOs find the podcast and enable me to create more great episodes. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode of the CTO Playbook.